Welcome to Justice Takes Courage, a podcast hosted by Bishop Julius C. Trumbull, General Secretary of the General Board of Church and Society.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Justice Takes Courage podcast. I'm your host, Bishop Julius Trumbull, General Secretary for the General Board of Church and Society. Today's topic is U.S. immigration, a polarizing and extremely difficult issue, and also, what is our response as people of faith? My guests today are both staff members of the General Board of Church and Society, Reverend Kendall McBroom, Director of Civil and Human Rights, and Reverend Laura Kiwebe, the Director of Grassroots Organizing. Kendall, let me start with you first. Can you give us a little legislative social history, if you will, on immigration in the United States?
Absolutely. And I just want to thank you, Bishop Trumbull, for having us on this podcast and to talk about this very important topic, the topic of immigration and migration. So as it relates to the history of immigration in the U.S., it's very complex and has an evolving narrative that reflects both the U.S. nation's ideals as well as its struggles with exclusion and discrimination. So some of the first immigration laws come to us in 1790 with the Naturalization Act, which essentially restricted citizenship to free white persons, excluding Black, Indigenous, those who were already in this land, and Asian populations. Throughout the 19th century, waves of Irish and German immigrants arrived, often facing hostility and discrimination. Then if you move forward into between the 1880s and the 1920s, millions of Southern and Eastern Europeans, including Italians, people of Jewish descent, Polish descent, arrived in search of economic opportunity and freedom from persecution. This is where Ellis Island became a primary processing center for immigrants. And then we move into our modern day debates and our modern day history as it relates to those of Hispanic descent, Latinx descent, as well as African descent coming into the country. And we see almost a complete shift from that early, or a reversion, if you will, back to earlier notions, the founding notions, if you will, of immigration in this country. So it's a very fraught history, a very complex history as it relates to immigration in this country, where we have welcomed some at certain times and certain periods of our history and excluded others, as we see happening today.
What are some of the harms caused by the current executive orders by this new Trump administration?
Yeah, there are a number of harms. First and foremost, I want to touch on the dignity aspect. We're in a season and a particular point where it is okay for leaders in the highest positions of this country to dehumanize and to criminalize those who are immigrants, those who are migrants, those who are refugees, and those who are seeking asylum. So there's on a human to human aspect, we're dehumanizing people with these executive orders. Also, there's been the suspension of the refugee admissions program, which essentially caused harm to those organizations that would aid individuals awaiting resettlement. This has also led to pandemonia, if you will, because individuals' flights were canceled. They had prepared, had plans to arrive in a place to be resettled, to be free from harm, if you will. And that was all cut loose by one of the executive orders by the Trump administration. Furthermore, the revocation of the sensitive locations memo also allowed for a fear to impart upon communities who are migrant communities or those that serve with migrant communities. This was, as we know, the sensitive locations policy from the DA, from DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, put a buffer, if you will, for ICE, for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and basically stated that there were certain locations that they could not harm, those being churches, those being places of faith, those being hospitals, schools. And so that was a way for individuals to have a bit of respite, if you will, to really live their lives free from fear of
free from the fear of knowing that while they were praying or while they were getting care in the hospital or while they were learning in the school or even teaching in the school, that they would not be under duress or in harm's way. That has since been revoked. And so these are some of the harms and dangers that the executive orders of this administration have really brought about.
So it's not clear for some people, what rights do immigrants have? And, you know, what can ICE do and what can they not legally do in this rush to deport millions of people?
Yeah, so I think the understanding of ICE's authority has, in this particular situation, in this particular instance, been extremely skewed. At the baseline, the rights of immigrants, and we say this in our social principles, which are part of the United Methodist social principles, but we also say this broader than that as it relates to the UN documents of the right to asylum, the right to seek asylum, the right to security. Those are international laws, right? So those are international rights that people have. Having said that, nations do have their own laws, but the danger and what we're seeing here as it relates to the deportation process and what ICE has been able to do is essentially identify, detain, and remove individuals who violate the nation's, the US's immigration laws. But we have to understand that there are also these international laws, right, that are in place that essentially do protect people. And these are what our social principles get at, that they talk about in talking about how we affirm the dignity, the worth, and the right of the migrant, the immigrant, the refugee, stateless peoples. We affirm that right of them. ICE has to adhere to constitutional protections, right? ICE has to do that. What we're seeing now is all those things have gone out the window. Those protections have gone out the window. I want to bring into the conversation a program carried out by ICE, which is the 287G program. 287G gives legitimacy to and gives authority to local governments, local law enforcement agencies. So your sheriff's department, your police department, it gives them license to essentially conduct raids and roundups on behalf of ICE, right? So ICE has a limited capacity, but they've now given local governments, local law enforcement agencies, the authority to violate these constitutional protections, right? Because we have in our Constitution, right, with the Fifth Amendment, the protection against unlawful search and seizure. That is standard. But now ICE and those who have become a part of this 287G program are able to thwart that and go against that and really infringe on people's human rights, first and foremost, and then also their civil liberties.
What can we do, people of faith and United Methodists in particular, to influence local law enforcement departments working with ICE? How can we come along? I'm going to ask both of our guests this question. How can we come alongside those persons who are living this in real time, even as we're speaking?
Yeah, I think I've talked a lot, so I'm going to turn it over to my colleague to allow her to answer, add some insight on that.
Thank you, Kendall, and thank you, Bishop Trimble, for this conversation, which is such a timely one. In terms of response, I also want to ground within my own story of why I'm doing this work. I am a daughter of immigrants. I'm first generation African American. My parents are from Burundi. Both of my parents are naturalized citizens. And this work, as much as it is deeply a call of our church, it's also deeply personal. And so when we're talking about these responses in terms of the church really taking a stand against where enforcement is placed from whether that is the state as well as local law enforcement, of like how in our responses do we center dignity and care? And I think a very simple way that churches can respond is alternative ways of engaging with law enforcement and making sure first that our communities feel cared for and seeing if there are other ways to show up. And if law enforcement does enter, kind of reaching out and getting informed through Know Your Rights, and one of our partners, Immigration Law and Justice Network, does incredible Know Your Rights training, as well as other community partners, and figure out what can you do if law enforcement is in the space, and how can you, at those times, center the care and dignity of those who are directly impacted, which are immigrants in this season, who are being targeted, which speaks to, as Kendall, you already named, the reality of how racism has functioned in the U.S. that has criminalized people of color, especially Black folks that have always had this complicated relationship when it comes to surveillance and enforcement. And so I think our responses have to be centered in dignity. They have to be centered in understanding that the care of the of people who are directly impacted is at the center of it all. And so, and I think that care starts with the knowledge of how to show up in your rights, and then also how to show up with other folks through accompaniment. And my colleague Kendall has an incredible toolkit out around accompaniment with migrants and what that looks like to know the language of what the church believes, and then also being able to share that in spaces where law enforcement shows up, and be able to walk alongside to in care of asking folks for what they really need. But I think a part of that too requires intentional relationship as well. And so how can we show up for one another authentically with care in these ways? So, and Kendall, I don't know if you have anything else to add there as well.
No, the only thing I was going to add, and I think I really agree that rooting our response in dignity, right, is vital because of the position and the way that we enter into this work, right? Laura enters into it, you enter into it as a product of immigrants. I enter into it as one that has seen and remembers when 287G was first implemented, and how in my hometown of Alamance County, the sheriff was actually indicted by the DOJ for the use of this program and the abuse of this program, right? Mm. So I've seen it where check stops and checkpoints are now concentrated in certain places of the city, of the county, and it is a criminalizing, it is a dehumanizing experience for our siblings who are essentially at the core trying to have peace, trying to be secure, trying to flourish and live these lives, right? As we say in the church, as scripture says, as Jesus says, I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly. Mm-hmm. People are literally just trying to do that and are unable to because of these harmful acts. And so another aspect that I would add as far as what can be done, engage with your local government, with your local sheriff's department, and affirm to them or let them know that this is not a policy or a program that we want to partner on. We are not that community. Stand up for the values of the community. Stand up for the spirit of the community. And then for your neighbors who are possibly undocumented, who might be a refugee, who might be migrating or might be an immigrant or a migrant, stand with them as a protecting factor, but also as a collaborative partner as far as navigating these waters.
Mm-hmm. Laura, you're a director of organizing, and how have United Methodists historically organized to respond to immigration justice? And what does that response look like today?
Yeah, thank you so much. So historically, as Kendall just named, United Methodists have taken a stand in the public square. Like, we have been that witness on the front lines, reclaiming this narrative of dignity. And actually, as I was preparing for this conversation, we have lots of archives at Church of Society, and one of them is the United Methodist Immigration Reform, a grassroots journal that covered a period of 2009 to 2015. And Bishop Trimble, you are in it in your time in Iowa. and sharing of the history of holding space during the first iteration of the Trump administration, where things then were even unquestionable around what was happening with immigration. But we also know even before the Trump administration that the immigration system has not been just, it has not been equitable. And the United Methodist Church has been at the center of being that voice of, yes, welcome, but also what are the pathways to citizenship that create a journey towards immigration that is just, right? That there aren't qualifiers of you have to have certain amount of money or a certain level of education in order to have your livelihood within a nation. And the United Methodist Church has been a witness of what does welcome and what do just policies look like, from advocating around sanctuary to addressing detention to a couple of years ago, we had an incredible campaign that was led with known as National Justice for Our Neighbors, now is Immigration Law and Justice Network, called All of Us Campaign. And during that campaign, we're advocating for the 11 million folks with a various status to have a pathway to citizenship. And over 70 United Methodists joined in that call. And there was a whole week of kickoff. And then we had different advocacy tactics, from prayer vigils to letter to your editors, and of course, visiting your members of Congress. And it was that beautiful array of collective action that was our witness. That is a history that we come from, of centering our witness, this drive of our personal faith connecting to this larger call to address social systems, call to social holiness, of even making the conditions around us holy. And how do we do that through our collective witness and testimony and centering love and grace in the world, both in the church as well as society? And so that campaign was an example that I think carries us into this moment, where we as United Methodists continue to gather to discern how can we use our churches, our connectional relationships that we have as the United Methodist Church, to really be this prophetic witness in the public square in this time. And, you know, one of the ways that we have leaned into that was the webinar that we did on February 10th, the Solidarity with a Sojourner, where we partnered with UMCOM, Council of Bishops, Immigration Law and Justice Network, G-Corps, United Women in Faith, UMCOR. And we had this conversation where Kendall, you again presented about what is the reality of the situation of immigration, the executive orders, but then how do we come together with our theological knowledge? And I wanted to mention Reverend Dr. Munoz, who represents El Plan for Hispanic and Latino Ministries, to give us this practical responses of how churches can center care from the congregational from a congregational aspect, as well as in the community partnerships. And so that way of how we engage right now happens through relationship. And I think especially as Methodists, our call as members, right, our prayers, our presence, our service, our gifts, our witness, all of those ways are great entry points even now to how we can show up in solidarity with migrants and really address the core of how we transform the conditions of injustice. We've already had a broken immigration system. And there's this question of like, how do we not just fix it, but create a system that centers justice and dignity at its core? And it is possible when we stand and when we witness.
It seems to be a absence of any discourse at all about comprehensive immigration reform from our elected officials. The whole conversation seems around deportation and numbers, as if we're not dealing with real people. Our neighbors, some of our church members, those folks who work in our restaurants, those folks who work in the fields, those folks that we see every day. There seems to be very little conversation at all about, as you said, Laura, you know, what can we do to fix it? What can we do to allow people to become citizens in this country without all of these barriers that make it almost literally impossible? What does solidarity tangibly look like? You've already answered this a bit, but what does solidarity look like within the immigrant community? How can we make sure, and I'm a big proponent of prayer, we should be praying, How can we make sure that the immigrant community and our neighbors really feel like, well, the church is really with us and for us?
Yeah, I want to jump in and speak to this really quickly because I'm just returning from an incredible moment where Representative Ramirez from Illinois, who's also United Methodist, herself as well as an entire group of bipartisan leaders in the House, it reintroduced the Dream and Promise Act that is, yes, specifically for DACA recipients, but also is inclusive of 5 million immigrants, including those with TPS and others. And so as you named, yes, the discourse is around mass deportations right now, but there are members of Congress who are like, no, like we are still advocating for a pathway to citizenship. We know that it's possible. And I truly believe like where possibility is, that is where hope is as well. And so to see Representative Ramirez, who is a United Methodist, speak about her role as a member of Congress advocating for a pathway to citizenship and also sharing her own story around her partner having DACA and the challenges with that, with all of that. And then at the same time of now being naturalized. And so the discourse is happening, but I think as Representative Ramirez presented earlier today, the sense of solidarity really comes from being in relationship. What I appreciated so much about Representative Ramirez's words was it wasn't just about what was happening on the Hill. It was about what was happening in the community. And I think for us, especially as United Methodists, it is this understanding too that we are immigrants, right? We have to recognize that, especially within the context of the U.S., that all of this is indigenous land. All of this was once known and is still known as Turtle Island. And so what does it mean with that indigenous history to be an authentic relationship? Yes, the indigenous experience, but then also to all of the other experiences that make up America. One of the other representatives that spoke at the press conference that introduced the Dream and Promise Act spoke that America is America because of immigrants. And so that is a relational proclamation. And so how, as people of faith, do we first approach immigrant communities as our own, of like, how are we creating authentic and intentional relationships at our core with anyone, right? Mm-hmm. But specifically with those who are directly impacted. But I also want to be careful to say that we can't just be making relationships with folks because they are directly impacted. Like, we should know folks in our congregations, period. We should have partnerships with communities, period. Like, we should know the folks who making this connection to food justice. Like, where does your food come from? Who are the farm workers? Like, who are the caretakers of our communities? This work for justice, especially from policy to systems change, all of it is about relationships. And when we talk about organizing the simple, not simple, but complicated sometimes practice of bringing people together to create change, at the core of it is relationship, which is a part of our faith, right? Justice is how are we being in right relationship with one another. That is what justice is. And solidarity in that is being able to practice that in a way that speaks to the wholeness in one another. And I'll end here because I know I've been talking a lot, but it was interesting as I was walking back to the building because I was rushing to another meeting, this gentleman said hello to me. And I know some of you who may be listening aren't always in the hustle and the bustle of Capitol Hill, especially in these early spring days where there's like so many folks on the Hill, but it is rare often for someone just to say hello. And it almost caught me off guard before I entered in the building, but it did cause me to pause and just to say, hi. And coming from that press conference and into the building where this person just stopped me to say hi was this moment of remembering the importance of seeing one another in this work, of taking a moment to see our full humanity and honoring it as God calls it, it is good, as it is holy. And I think that is where the beginning of the solidarity work happens, is recognizing the fullness of God and our humanity in one another and taking the time to see it.
this would be like my final question, and both of you can weigh in on it. We encourage collaboration, interfaith work, ecumenical work. What ways can United Methodists collaborate with faith and community partners to advocate for immigration justice? Most people aren't going to be coming to Washington, D.C. or New York, but a lot of the work takes place in our own communities, in our own church communities. So how might you encourage those who might be listening on ways United Methodists can collaborate with faith and community partners?
Yeah, sure. I'm thinking about some stuff that my congregation, congregations that I know have done this work or are doing this, and then those that are planning to. And I'm thinking about the, for example, on one side of it, you have organizations similar, satellite offices of ILJ in different states and different locations. So I would suggest partnering with trusted partners out similar to ILJ, the Immigration Law and Justice, partnering with them and seeing one about getting trained as far as like know your rights trainings. That would be a practical way. But then also to your point, Bishop, earlier regarding prayer, that probably would be the first step as far as praying and discerning what is the need of the people I am in community with. What is the need of the sojourner in my midst? And how do I show up for them in the ways that they need me to show up? Because I think it is very unbeneficial and very colonizing, if you will, to say, well, this is what they need and this is what I'm going to do. It's very harmful, very dangerous, and also not too helpful. But rather, as Laura had mentioned, when you have that relationship, when you know that every Tuesday when you go to that cafe, you know the cook or you know the waiter or you know the waitress, and you've built that relationship and you can open up and have that conversation and say, what is it that you need? How can I support you? How can I stand in solidarity with you? And then pray about how to move and discern how the Spirit is leading and guiding you. Some other things are, which may be a little bit difficult in this climate out of fear, but I would say after knowing that and understanding the risks with that, be a resource to the children of immigrants. Be a resource to them in the sense of maybe there are educational classes, maybe there are reading or math or ESL. Doing things of that nature that really bolster their confidence and bolster their dignity and protect their humanity, protect their dignity in this very harmful and toxic moment. Because as has been said, it is a lot easier to raise a healthy child than it is to build back up a broken adult. And I'm paraphrasing that, but essentially, when we make that investment in the youth and in the children, and particularly as it relates to their dignity, to remind them that you are made in the image of God. I don't care. I mean, we just had the story that broke a couple of days ago, I believe, about a young girl, about 11 or 12, who died by suicide because she was bullied for her immigration status. Because people were saying, adults and even children who had heard it from adults were telling her that she needed to go back to her country, that she wasn't worthy of citizenship. This is affecting real lives. This is affecting real youth. So anytime you have the opportunity to speak a positive word and deposit a positive nugget of truth, truth that you are made in the image of God, truth that you are fearfully and wonderfully made, truth that you are the head and not the tail, truth that God loves you, that God cares for you. And as your neighbor, I am to do the same. Anytime we have the opportunity to do that, we ought to make that a priority.
Yeah.
I've been encouraging people to go to umcjustice.org. Laura and Kendall, are there other resources or statements that the United Methodist Church has made? I know that we have something called as Social Principles, Book of Resolutions. Are there other resources? Where do you direct people to get more information? A person might say, I'm a United Methodist. I'm not sure exactly what our position is.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great question. And just to kind of, I guess, piggyback off of what Kendall just named, this is a great opportunity for, especially for clergy who are listening, to start incorporating the social principles and what the church says and also has resolved to do in the Book of Resolutions around immigration. There are so many statements there that share, again, like our witness. And I do believe in the sermonic moment is where we can take a stand in our community. And that is also a place to build relationships for folks who you may not even know in your congregation are immigrants, and to be able to engage in the sermon is a powerful way to do that. And for folks who are immigrants that are serving in our congregations, to the level that you feel comfortable, to even familiarize yourself with what we say as a church through the social principles. And if the social principles or the Book of Resolutions are too intimidating, at umcjustice.org, we have our Faith and Fact cards that are wonderful entry points to understand what the church says, what scripture says, and what do the facts say. And, you know, it was incredible at that press conference on the Dream and Promise Act, there were just specific facts, right? Facts are so important, even in a world of misinformation, when you have the right information that talks about the number of folks with DACA and how much in terms of over $130 million of taxes, like making that connection. And this was a representative from Massachusetts that was just talking about over 12,000 DACA persons who have DACA in the state and over $130 million with taxes. And like making that connection of impact is huge. And so those Faith and Fact cards talk about the reality of immigration and the facts tied to it. And those are great inserts that you can put in your church bulletins or share on your website, and also share with your community partners to say, this is what we believe. So I think that those are really helpful resources. And then I also want to name one of our partners, the Interfaith Immigration Coalition. They do have a website, and it is a great place for toolkits. There's been an ongoing campaign called Welcome with Dignity, specifically around asylum seekers, but the current campaign is This is Welcome, that speaks to gathering and naming and reclaiming a culture of welcome over the reality of fear that has been created right now by the Trump administration. And as people of faith, that is who we are at our core. We are people of radical hospitality. And so that's another resource that I would just lift up, is the Interfaith Immigration Coalition and the website that they have. I'm sure we can drop that in the show notes.
Thank you so much. All of this work that we do is rooted in scripture as well as our Wesleyan heritage. And I want to thank these two outstanding staff people with the General Board of Church and Society. Both are preachers too. And so we want to thank you for your contribution to the Justice Takes Courage podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
God bless.
Thank you for listening to Justice Takes Courage, a podcast hosted by Bishop Julius C. Trimble, General Secretary of the General Board of Church and Society.